During the Renaissance, it was dangerous enough to print forbidden books, such as an English translation of the Bible. Turns out that the process of printing itself came with its risks, and we'll look at some of them during this conversation. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. My guest is Joshua Calhoun, professor of English at the UW-Madison and a student of the whole process and history of printing. And it turns out to be quite the phenomenon, of course, still very much with us, but one phenomenon that has changed over the years quite a bit. Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
I haven't seen you since our conversation about John Donne, which was also a personal favorite of mine. Well, speaking of John Donne and his time, we go back to the Renaissance. And is this really the beginning of what we're going to be talking about in terms of printing Gutenberg and his famous Bible?
Yeah, we could certainly start there. Yeah, I mean, it's a time period when, you know, the social landscape is changed by this technology that allows you to quickly reproduce words that they had the same worries then that we have now with the internet. It's a time when we see a real anxiety about, wow, suddenly somebody could, you know, you could print so many books that one person couldn't read them in their whole life, you know, all the books available. And so there's it's an early information overload that we feel now. And Gutenberg certainly, you know, there are other types of printing that are happening in East Asian countries, but they're the woodblock printing typically, not mass producing. It's the scale at which Gutenberg was able to mass produce and the use of metal type, these just, you know, individual letters you could move around and take apart and reconfigure. And that's what revolutionizes the book. But what's also interesting is that that's a technology that, as many people have pointed out, it's basically around. I mean, you've got an oil, you know, wine press, or an olive press, or you got the press technology, and people have been stamping things for a long time. Roman
sure.
Stamping bread.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's
royal
not stamping
seals.
Something. Printing mm-hmm. is not. Yeah, this is not. Neither of those technologies are particularly new or exciting. It's putting them together, and the thing that's interesting there is that why would you put those two together? Why at this point was it that it just took so long for a genius like Gutenberg to come along? Well, you were using animal skins. And the rate at which you could reproduce with Gutenberg's press could far outstrip how quickly you could reproduce, or you could make animal skins to print onto. And it's the move of paper from east to west, paper made of plant fibers that could be quickly produced and then mass produced upon. That really is the what some scholars call the precondition of the press.
Have you seen any people of those times, the Renaissance, the Gutenberg times, expressing qualms about what might be lost, a sense of like depersonalization between this thing that's written out by hand so lovingly and painstakingly
yeah.
and something that's just kind of like you say, modular, just thrown together the letters and it's printed 100 of them and there's no direct connection between the user and the sender.
Sure. Well, you're making me go all over the place here. First of all, I think if some people may have been to the APT's production of Merry Wives of Windsor, was it 2 years ago? And we see Falstaff sends two identical letters to two different women, and they say, you know, he may as well have just printed them and then filled in the name, right? So he's doing exactly.
Some things never change.
Yeah, he's doing exactly that. And certainly there's the there's anxieties about that. We see early printed texts look like manuscripts. Gutenberg's Bible, printed in 14. We usually put it right around 1455. You know, it probably started production 54, and maybe it was wrapped up 56. But it's that is called the 42 line Bible often. And if you look at it, replicates looks like a hand written text that's been stamped. The paper is being made with very, very heavy paper. He also prints some on vellum, but he prints most of them on paper, and it's a very heavy paper that's meant to sort of seem like what scholar Timothy Barrett calls imitation parchment. And so that's very much replicating that. We even see there'll be these we see them sometimes. It's kind of fascinating. You'll see printed books where there's a big hole, blank space, and they're a little tiny letter, like a C, and it's a guide letter. And what it is, it's for the rubricator. That's they've printed a very small letter to tell the rubricator after they've printed the book. Now you're going to go back and you're going to hand draw.
Oh,
in.
Really?
So they're mixed. You know, it's a mixture of manuscript and print. And only later do we really get into something we might think of monochrome printing. I mean, early printing is still trying to do some colors or have rubricators add things in. So it's there's a lot of that intermixing, and I think that it's actually a fascinating time to be thinking about it, and even for me teaching it here at the university, because it's so many of the questions we ask about ebooks and what we think is real books were the sorts of concerns, the depersonalization, for instance, of an email versus a letter.
How many of those Bibles would Gutenberg be able to print? How many do we know of? Any idea?
Yeah, I believe the number is 180. And what I'm trying to remember is I think about 50 of them are printed on vellum, and I think that's included in the 180 number. Although that may be over the top, you might have me there. But it's in that 200 range. Yeah.
So what was the second book that he did? what could you do to to follow the first act of the Bible?
Well, arguably the Bible is the second book. He what's always been true in the history of printing is that we think of printers printing books, but they make their living a lot of times by printing posters and ballads and broadsides and short things that they can set up quickly, print a bunch of, and then take the type, because type's got to be taken apart. Setting up a book like the Gutenberg Bible was a massive expense. So there, you'll see a lot of pamphlets being printed, and this is, we see this from the history. This is called job pressing. You'll see all the way through. Franklin is a job presser. But even now, again, moving all the way forward, I did an internship at Outside Magazine after my undergrad. Had thoughts of doing journalism, and realized it's about as hard to get a job there as teach at a university. Thought I'd go
saying through, a lot.
Yeah. But one of my buddies there, who was also an intern with me, the one who's actually done really well for himself, he does an independent press. He does magazines for an independent press. They'll do sort of bespoke magazines for different smaller groups. And while other magazines like Gourmet, I believe, things like that are shuttering up, the private press, the job press kind of work has not slowed down for him at all. Last time I talked to him, which is too long ago now that I think of it, we've depersonalized. I need to send him a letter.
Yeah, that's right. Handwritten, no doubt. A printer like Gutenberg then would have been actually printing pamphlets and that sort of thing before even he printed the Bible.
As far as we know, now I will say this for the sake of anyone at home who's just cringing. This is sort of the beginning of my period back in what we call the incunable period, which is the first 50 years of the printing press. It's the cradle of bookmaking. I know a reasonable amount about papermaking then, but the actual printing, I'm currently learning German because I'm taking a trip over with Che for the – I'm affiliated with Nelson Institute. So we're going down the Danube River in the with the Rachel Carson Center over there. But I'm learning German, but I don't read it well, and I would defer to somebody on exactly what's being printed, but I know that he didn't just have the technology and say, okay, well, now I'll print a Bible. He's obviously testing it out on smaller projects.
Easy for us to think that he just, let's print a Bible, but he obviously had other things going before that.
The problem, of course, being what survives, and I'd love to talk about that, eventually, but survival is a big question of, what do we think happened based on what survives? Because these are all plant, animal, mineral bits of matter, and they decompose and they move and they circulate in new ways. That's what they always wanted to do, but we have stopped, in many cases, stopped them. So you can go to the Huntington and see a Gutenberg Bible in an arrested state of decay, just like people would have seen the first folio here last semester if they were able to come over to the Chazen. There it is, and it's in its own little box, and it's relative temperature, relative humidity, and it's being It's being stopped from dying. It's in a coma. It's not been pulled off the plug. We're essentially putting it on the plug and trying to keep it from dying.
So does papermaking then come in at this roughly the same time, 1455 or so, as opposed to parchment or vellum?
It's coming in a little before. What we're seeing is it again, as I say, I think it's a precondition for printing. You say, oh, suddenly we have this. What could we do with it? Suddenly it spurs that invention of making a press. Interestingly, England is a net exporter of books prior to the introduction of paper because it's on animal skins.
Look,
and then after that,
sheep.
I believe it's until, at least the 18th, I believe actually may even be late 18th or early 19th century before they're a net exporter as opposed to, the evening out or importing more books. So papermaking early on, they're developing the craft, and they're making very good paper. I mentioned Tim Baird earlier. He's a master papermaker, had a MacArthur Award for his work. And in talking with him, he's still on the quest to make paper that he thinks is as good as the paper they were making back then. And there's a lot of considerations, right down to the bacteria that would have been used as like a starter for redding or rotting those rags. There's a lot of ecological and scientific considerations of what actually paper is. And while they don't understand that it's creating a new sort of bond with the cellulose fibers, they don't use the language that we now know to use. They certainly understood the craft of it, and there's some beautiful papers. Even right here, I've just last week had students over looking at a copy of Bartolomaeus's De Proprietatibus Rerum, printed by Caxton in 1493 on paper made in England by a guy named John Tate. And it's beautiful paper.
So paper can last as long as parchment?
Not as long, but it can last a long time, and that's become not just a question of academic speculation, but one of national concern to England recently. They print certain parts of the Parliament records printed onto parchment or vellum. Each one gets printed that way, and it has been that way for a very long time. They wanted to change that to save some money, and there was an outcry about the durability. And so certainly the belief is well-made parchment would last longer. I'm using parchment we could use synonymously. In many cases it is used. Vellum typically is, we think of the way to think of it is veal. It's calf. Parchment might be sheep, but you see it in the Renaissance used sometimes interchangeably, parchment usually more as a catch-all for all of them, vellum for a more high-quality kind of parchment, what they thought of as a young calf being used.
So it would actually be I'm kind of reminded of a conversation I had a few years ago with a carpet dealer.
Okay.
Persian carpets, and he says, you can't get them this way anymore because the sheep are grazing on grass that has different constituents in mm-hmm. it, and therefore the wool is different, and you
That's
cannot
right.
duplicate a Persian carpet from 1850 exactly in the 21st century. It sounds like that's the same with the paper.
Yeah, it's true. It's true with a lot of things. Paper, there are things that are different. Even the water quality. I mean, so much of papermaking is water. When you're making the paper, this is handmade paper that you're essentially drawing a sieve. I think it's on a window screen through a tub that's filled with 99% water and 1% of a pulp that's pulped up fibers, pulped up clothing. Most of the history of paper, by the way, is recycled. Clothing. We think of it as, save a tree, send me an email. That's more recent. We think of it as post-Civil War. But for most of the history of papermaking, we're seeing it on recycled clothing. And it's connected to people's clothing because it was connected to Thoreau talks about the sails that are being used to make paper. So there's a lot of connections with the fibers. But you're right that it's a kind of object that has – it accrues a lot of meaning along the way, and it accrues a lot of people touch it and change it and the water would change it. And even we can see evidence, that for instance, paper that's particularly dark being made in the spring when the water is running murkier. So the water quality certainly changes. That's one example of a thing that changes it. But I would say, though, that still make it, the attempt at making, if I could bend that question over, I was speaking with a colleague, an Anglo-Saxonist, Martin Foy's here, and he was talking about this, authentic attempts to make Twitchell in Brooklyn or something like that. And how you can't actually, there's an article about how you can't actually authentically make it. But of course, it's in the attempt to make that you learn so much. And so I've been working with a local papermaker here, Robert Posell. And I take my classes over and they make paper. And even in my grad class right now that's called Book Ecology, we went over, we spent the evening making paper with him. He was very gracious, went over to Edgewood College where he teaches. And, it changes the conversation we can have about the quality of what we're looking at. And when we go into the archives and touching the paper, we can't make it authentically, but we can use some authentic practices. And I know in my own work, I've learned some things from makers, from hand paper makers, hand printers, that scholars have told me is not possible. And and people who do it have told me, oh, yeah, of course.
Theory versus practice.
So the getting that making aspect, well, I agree. You can never get the real thing, the authentic thing. You can learn a lot from it.
How safe was it making paper? I mean, obviously the political things aside from the actual printed book, but the actual process of making paper and then printing books as we look at it in the Renaissance in particular, what were the environmental standards and the hazards involved, if any?
Yeah, well, there was no OSHA in play back then. There's a lot of risk when you think about any even just living the mortality rate being higher. There's not as much if something happens to you, if you get a wound, not as good of health care in terms of what they knew how to do and how to treat injuries. So injuries, even small injuries could become big injuries as we might think of them now. There certainly are records of people getting body parts caught in the various machinery. When you're thinking about that first step of papermaking, you've got a big water wheel, and you've got then inside you've got it's often women doing the work of cutting up the rags and chopping them and sorting them out, and then they're being rotted, and there's always environmental concerns, not only in the papermaker's establishment, but outside, the greater community, they're just rotting all these rags and the smell of that, I mean, people who live near a paper mill now, even, you get that. It's a different reason.
Yeah, sure.
But and then they were polluting. I mean, as far, everything goes in the river. So it's also, there's a lot of waste that's going into the river. It's probably with paper making, it's as dangerous for the fish as it is for the makers. But it's also the, especially the women who are cutting up those rags. You can imagine think about those particles of the dust that comes up from just hacking up rags.
Yes.
Over time, they're inhaling a lot of dust, a lot of particles.
Who knows what state of health the previous owner of that garment was in?
Well, and you raise a good point. I mean, I'll come back to printing, but this is the one, a fascinating part of it, is the idea that there would be pleggy paper.
Yeah, right. I didn't want to go there, but I invited you to.
Yeah, yeah. there are concerns, and there are questions. What if? The paper has. What if the paper's been used? The rag that became the paper has been used by someone who had the plague, and this is a time when you're seeing plague outbreaks. From the 1590s, more than every 10 years. It's like 1593 and 1603-4, 1609, and on. There are a lot of times of plague, and then there's also continental plague, and that's there where some of the rags are coming in from the continent, or some of the papers coming in from the continent. For the Dutch and the French are making most of the paper that's used in English books. So then it's also who knows what those French are doing, right? You see in Shakespeare always the reference to like the French disease, or it's always the think of pox, I think it's somebody else's disease that they bring in. So it's a foreigner's disease. So there's also the foreign foreign illness coming in the form of paper. So there's a lot of concerns when it comes to paper. And then when it comes to printing, you're dealing with if you're making the type, you're dealing with molten lead. You're dealing with a large machine. You're also dealing with a scale of production where you got to pay it. You know, you got to stay on your game. And if you mess up, it's you know, be bumping into small shops. You'd be bumping in, and it, you know, there you could easily have. And we do have records of some injuries. We also just have you got a lot of apprentices. You got a lot of people learning it. They're coming into apprenticeship in their teens, and they're going to be serving for 7 years. And hopefully, they do all right, and they don't die. And it's the apprentices are living in close quarters, and you know, there's always. The sense that if they mess up, that it might not be that the press is going to hurt them, but you know, if they mess up, the master is going to beat them, and probably in many cases with full legal rights to do so for the mistake.
Were these pretty much middle class operations?
It's interesting to think about a middle class in this period, because it doesn't. There's an emerging what we might think of as a middle class and a merchant class. I think using our way of looking back at it now, we'd probably call them middle class.
So they were owned by families typically?
Yeah, they could be owned by families. A stationer or a book printer may have multiple presses. They also may have had a separate press for printing engravings, because that's an intaglio, is a separate printing process, where instead of the printing press is using what's called relief printing. You're printing anything that is sticking up. If you imagine carving a block of wood, anything that's sticking up is what's going to be printed in engraving. It's going to be the opposite. Anything that's carved in will be printed. So there's two different presses. You need more pressure for that other one. So there's other presses that are being used. It'd be owned by a family. Sort of think of a master who would have apprentices, maybe have a family there. And one of the fascinating things is that printing in England, by the 1600s, there's multiple presses that we know that are that are owned and being operated by women who were widowed. Because it did pass to them. So there was an interesting history there. I was recently reading a nice article on it by a scholar named Helen Smith on the number of women printers in this period.
Unlike other professions, comparable professions, this one somehow worked better for women.
Yeah, and I mean, I think some professions you still had that, but it's a question of, you know, does a stationer, does a printer have... do they have ink on their fingers? You know, are they running an operation? I mean, is the person who's running Random? Now, this is a much bigger example. Random House, right? Are they in the press? Are they running the press? And there's sort of different ways to think about it. Certainly, it's in terms of management, it's economics. Oikos, the house. It's the law of the house, and running that printing house would be not. Not dissimilar in terms of the way that you would think about management to the way you'd manage an estate or something like that.
We're going to follow this phenomenon, especially the environmental phenomenon of printing, further when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Joshua Calhoun, and we're looking at this phenomenon called printing, especially in its early days back in the 16th and early 17th centuries. And we've discovered so far that, among other things, printing is very much a product of its environment, the making of paper and the printing of paper. And we haven't talked really yet about inks. And where they come from.
Yeah.
And so is it possible to recreate an ink from the 17th century? We said you couldn't really do it with paper because the environment has changed since then. But what about ink?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you can recreate. I mean, again, a purist would say you can't perfectly recreate it. You can't have the same thing, but you don't have the same dirt on your fingers, right? while you're making it. But certainly, there are different kinds of ink you can make. It's the ink for writing would have been water based. So I mean, water's easy enough. And then you would have used an oak gall, which is a growth that's caused by an excrescence is technically on oak trees that's caused by the laying of a wasp, that laying of the eggs of the wasp, kind of, and the ones that are unopened are from Aleppo. They're trying to get Aleppan galls, the ones that they most want in this period.
Aleppo, wow.
And so those are really given like a binding agent, and you can use different pigments. You can use lamp black. Different sorts of ingredients. That what we have really is we have a bunch of recipe books. The practice of learning to read this old writing, which is typically in this thing called secretary hand, is called paleography, and you can look at these old recipe books. And in fact, for those recipes for ink, recipes for everything. What's amazing is these kind of household recipes that are just for you'll find a recipe for sickness and a recipe for ink making but ink making you see a lot, because how do you write the recipe for what to do when you come down with a sickness if you don't have ink? So in many of those household books, recipes for ink are often present. You want a few basic ingredients in there. It's interesting when you think about where they're getting them all from different parts. But you want your Aleppan galls or your gallnuts, but you can get those gallnuts. You might be able to find one on a tree outside. And so that's you also get an iron sulfate. So what they typically use is called iron gall ink, and it's got a binding agent in it as well. It's a gum arabic that's kind of given this little stickiness, but it's also burning in. I mean, ink is from the Latin incosta. It's burning into the page, or so it has that gall in it, and then water or sometimes wine they might use. But it's sort of those kind of four basic things. You can also, though, use for pigment. If you wanted to, you could probably get away from the galls and the iron and go to a soot or a lamp black. So you'd almost, if you imagine, it's burning a candle with a really high wick, and then reaching inside there and getting that lamp black. That's another kind of ink. Now that'll wash off. That won't burn in. So that doesn't have if you write it on a page, you might be able to rub it off or wipe it, wash it off a little bit without damaging the page. And so that's not as permanent of an ink.
Did they use much colored inks at this time? Or is it mostly black, just black?
In the writing, mostly black ink, which is interesting now, because when we look at it now, it's brown. But the ink, you'll see in various poetry talking about the blackness of your lines. So when they're writing with it, it has a nice, probably jet black color to it. But over time, it oxidizes and it turns a more of a brown color. So with most of the manuscripts we see now, they're brown ink, really.
Now, we've been talking about printing texts, but illustrations, charts, maps, they seem to come in pretty early if you're talking about, a cosmological tome of some kind, for example.
Yeah. No, there are certainly woodcuts that they're using for printing, and that would be using a printer's ink, an oil-based ink as opposed to a water-based ink. So it's more resinous, and you'd be using to print illustrations. Later on, you're getting the development of engraving, and then eventually lithographs, which is that's outside the period we're talking about here. But that development of being able to have illustrations and show what you mean, especially as you start to think about medical texts and how do you show the body, or botanical texts, how do you show what these plants look like, topsails, forfeited beasts we have next door of their special collections. And my students in my holding history program love to show that off. And it's got, you know, one, for instance, Durer's rhinoceros, but also, you know, a lot of animals that look like the animals we know and love, but also some animals that just look like something they heard a story about. Yeah. So there's a lot of, that's the other thing about printing is in its use of, say, oak galls or of water from a stream, or the ecological ingredients that come together to allow you to print onto a piece of paper that's made from plant fibers that have been, you know, worn as clothing, and then they've become, with the help of a stream, they've become paper. Once you do all that work, often, especially in this period, you're printing a lot of manuals about the natural world, about how to survey the land, or how to navigate, or what animals look like, or how to understand the plants, or how to, how to heal sick, to see really using nature to understand nature.
And we haven't talked about the binding process either. Was that typically leather and then sewn to the pages, or how was that done in the early 17th century?
Yeah, there's just gatherings, really, and you can often see it in a book now. You can see that they're together, but it's sewn together. They're sewn into these little groupings called quires, and then they're bound. Sometimes in leather, sometimes in boards. Actually, there's a poem that I brought with me that talks a little bit about binding, but also about the paper. Which, if you'd like, I'd be happy to read it to you. I think it's from 1655, and it's called The Book. And this is this is Henry Vaughan, who is coming after Herbert in his writing these sort of religious, but religious books, but also very much more of a naturalist than we might think of now. And he writes this, he's writing to God. This is a prayer. He says, "Eternal God, maker of all that have lived here since the man's fall, the rock of ages, in whose shade they live unseen, when here they fade." And he says, "Thou knewest this paper when it was mere seed, and after that but grass. Before 'twas dressed or spun and wind made linen, who did wear it then? What were their lives, their thoughts and deeds, whether good corn or fruitless weeds?" So here's God looking through the paper back to when it was being worn, back to when it was growing out of the ground, and back to when it was a seed. And then he says, "Thou knewest this tree." He's now looking at the binding. "Thou knewest this tree when a green shade covered it, since a cover made, and where it flourished, grew, and spread as if it never should be dead. Thou knewest this harmless beast when he did lie and feed by thy decree on each green thing, then slept well fed, clothed with this skin, which now lies spread, a covering o'er this aged book, which makes me wisely weep and look on my own dust. Mere dust it is, but not so dry and clean as this." And it goes on a little bit, but what he's saying here is that there was an animal sleeping under a tree. sort of the tree was covering and shading the animal by a cow. And then now in the book form, it's been reversed. Now there's a book board, and then that's leather stretched over the leather of this animal. And he's saying that, you know, that the all-knowing God can look down and see exactly, you know, he sees when a sparrow falls, and he sees when a cow is made into a book. But he has this great question. He says, what happens to the book? Because it's a Bible he's imagining. What happens to the Bible then, this Bible that's made out of you know, seeds and trees and cows, at the day of resurrection, when everything's restored to its perfect form?
which form will it
take? Does a Bible stay a Bible, or does it go back to being a cow?
That's downright metaphysical.
Yeah. He was grouped with the metaphysical poets for obvious reasons, yeah.
So let's look at the same time period. One of the most prominent books that we're aware of today, the first folio of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And how was that actually put together?
Yeah, it's similar to the way that books were put together by Gutenberg. The printing press is about 300 years. We don't see major changes there's certainly changes that are happening, improvements that are happening in the papermaking printing process. But as a technology, we don't see major overhauls. Here we are in 1623. Think about this first folio, and we're not quite 200 years after Gutenberg, and the technology is the press would look very similar. sort of the question: Could Gutenberg, you know, could you have resurrected Gutenberg and stuck him in, you know, on the line to help push print the folio? Are you people saying probably could have? You know, I mean, it's I'm not sure the value of that. You know, it's just kind of fun to think about, but it's familiar enough. When I think about the ecology of this this book, how it came together, you've got a book that to me is more interesting now because it's still with us. It's still in mass. The First Folio isn't a rare book by really any definition, I don't think. I mean,
really?
Original
First Folio.
Yeah, we think that there, I mean, as far as we know, there couldn't have been more than 750 printed of them. And we have about 250, a little less than that, but, you know, to round up just a tad. And probably there are some out there that some, you know, private owners. So we'll call it 250. So we'll say a third of the original First Folios are still, we know about. We have them somewhere, some library. You know, the Folger Shakespeare Library has, 70. They're being well preserved now. They were cut up and they were changed. They're moved around, but now they're really well preserved. We are able to keep them as in that display in relative, keep the relative temperature and humidity the same, and really preserve them in good shape. Intriguingly, something like the Folger, which is preserving that book in really good condition, the outside of the Folger, which is has a series of bas reliefs done in the 1930s in white Georgia marble, the same marble that, not the same kind of marble that was used for the Lincoln statue, and that the outside of the Folger is deteriorating. So Shakespeare and Hamlet's holding a little book, his little marble book, and it's falling apart on the outside of the Folger due to acid rain and some other contributing factors due to fungi and spores, but inside. The First Folio is in pretty good condition. It's as Johnson said, a lasting monument. It's doing pretty well.
A little bit ironic, isn't it?
Yeah.
That structure built to protect is actually declining faster than the thing it's protecting.
Yeah.
So for the First Folio, pretty typical for its time. In other words, leather bound.
Well, you know, the bindings were going to be determined by the owners, typically. They're sold in, since the books were sold in sheets. And then, yeah, you decide how you want to have it bound. So, they would have been bound in, this high quality of a book. This is the first book of its size. We say folio, that's just a size of book. It's a very large book.
Bigger than 8.5 by 11.
Yeah, you know, at one point, I was trying to think of ways to say how big it was, and I realized that when I was in high school, I played basketball. My coach loved Louis L'Amour. You took four Louis L'Amour novels and you put them right. People know, you put those in a sort of a rectangle.
The mass market paper.
There you go. Yep. Yeah. There you go. That's the size of a folio. And worth a bit more though,
a bit.
But they're certainly big books, and these were typically used for medical texts, for religious texts, for scientific texts. But this is the first in England, the first folio that's all plays.
For literary, than some scientific.
Yeah, there were some literary folios, but this is the first one that's all stage plays, which were it's unique for that in 1623.
Well, how about the first edition of the King James Version of the Bible? It's 1611?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
How does that compare in terms of the numbers made and the way it was made?
That's a great question. You know, this gets me onto biography a bit here, Norman. But I think I fell in love with Shakespeare because I grew up memorizing the King James Bible. I was raised in a home where I was raised in the Adirondack Mountains of New York. It's this forest preserve that's 6 million acres, but you're inside the park. So you're in the middle of nowhere, but also there's towns and villages inside. And then I was memorizing swaths of the King James Bible. So I have to say it's been interesting in my own field. There's a lot of interest in the religious books that I sort of felt like, well, no, I'm doing something different now. I found Shakespeare familiar, and it's one thing that I've always loved about Shakespeare is the familiarity of language. And I don't see I don't read Shakespeare as trying to sound highbrow. I don't think he is trying to sound highbrow.
No, how could he? He had to sell tickets.
Yeah, and you see, but you know, and it's always a joy to talk to students. But you know, we see thou and thee. These are intimate terms. This is not, you know, we think of this as distancing. But so I've got to say, I probably should know more about my Renaissance Bibles, but I don't know the numbers that were produced. But there's also so many reprints of these Bibles. Mm-hmm. I couldn't give you a number on how many of the King James Bibles were printed. My guess though is that it's you know, as far as I know, if we go all the way forward, which is sometimes we don't do, we think about a book being existing in the time it was printed. King James Bible, I would imagine, is the most printed book ever in the history of books, but. And that's always fascinating when you think about what books people had you know, when books were produced and how books get put together. But Shakespeare and the Bible certainly get put together a lot.
We'll look further at this phenomenon of printing and its relationship with the environment, too, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Joshua Calhoun, who is guiding us through the early years of printing and the manufacturing of books in the late 16th, early 17th centuries. Did anybody have a sense, or do we know, did anybody express a sense of the future of these books that were being printed? You know, they were so caught up with immortality in the Renaissance.
Yeah, how can you be remembered? Certainly, I mean, we see it throughout the sonnets, this Shakespeare sonnets, to try to, you know, be remembered or to remember the beloved, and how do you do that? Shakespeare talking about, you know, not marble. You know, he's talking about, is this going to be better than marble? I'm going to write it on paper, but of course, paper. You know, what's going to happen to this? I think it's really interesting to think about what they thought were the possibilities. Or what they imagined these materials could be. And I think that one thing that we see in the sonnet is a understanding that it's not going to be about finding the most durable object to carve your record into, but finding a reproducible object that can be copied and forwarded in some way. And so, you know, really, if you think about, you really want this message to go forward, you think about getting the toughest, you know, marble or something like that, or you get something that can just be transmitted easily and passed along. And so we see this with paper, really allows that, printing allows that. But one place we see this is John Donne, who we talked about last time we were together, and I know you enjoy him as much as I do.
Contemporary of Shakespeare.
Yeah, sure. He's writing certainly about the same time as Shakespeare, although not published until 1633, we have a first edition here on campus. I'd say parenthetically for listeners, you know, this is at the state university, like these archives, these special collections are the states, are the peoples. And, you know, I hope people know that they can just go up in there and, you know, you talk quickly how to handle the books and you have a look at some things.
Truly.
Certainly. But and I do a program called Holding History that we welcome people in and show them the books, and so something like being able to look and hold something like John Donne's 1633 poems, you know, this is always that question: how do I take my good idea and make it into something I can hold in my hands and I can share forward with others? And Donne imagines that in this poem called A Valediction of the Book. He's talking. It's written it's addressing his wife. We believe his wife, or else he would have wanted his wife to believe it if she saw this poem. he says, "There's all these letters have passed between them, twixt thee and me." And he says, "Here's what we're gonna do. I'll tell thee now, dear love, what thou shalt do to anger destiny, to sort of beat destiny, to outlive our own death." He says, "We're gonna take our letters and we're gonna make them into a book." And then he says, and I'll read one stanza here. He says, "This book, as long lived as the elements, or as the world's form, this all-graved tome in cipher writ or new-made idiom, we for love's clergy only are instruments. When this book is made thus, should again the ravenous Vandals and Goths inundate us, learning we're safe. In this our universe, schools might learn sciences, spheres, music, angels, verse. This is how the future will know what love really was, by looking at the book that they've made out of the poems. It's the book is as long-lived as the elements, which is an interesting way to put it. Because if you take a book and you set it outside, how long does that last? We don't have the manuscript of this particular poem. We do have it printed in the 1633 volume, and that's the way it gets forward to us. But I've a poem that really calls back to this is one from a 20th century poet, Wendy Cope, who's playing with this idea, and she's also playing with Shakespeare's sonnet 55, where he's talking about his verse lasting longer than marble or bronze. But she says of her poetry, this is again Wendy Cope in a book called From Strugnell's Sonnets. She says, "Not only marble, but the plastic toys from cornflake packets will outlive this rhyme. I can't immortalize you, love. Our joys will lie unnoticed in the vault of time."
It's certainly in the Donne tradition of a kind of an updating of Donne, you might say.
That's right. And interesting, she's aware of something that Donne isn't. She's aware of a vault. This vault of time. She calls it this vault of time. I don't think Donne knows that there's going to be a vault that his poetry could be kept from the Vandals and Goths in. Francis Bacon, as far as we know, died because he tried to refrigerate a chicken.
Yes.
I can't go into the whole story now, but he's trying to, he's trying to
stick it in the snow.
He's trying to put snow and pack it inside, and he's trying to see what you can do to keep flesh from decaying. And he dies in the 17th century. They had no clue that there would be archives where, I mean, when I go to the Folger Shakespeare Library, there's a tour that goes around. They can peek in the archives. And I wonder sometimes, because I'll be in there, and it's cold in there. And on certain days, it looks more like we're inside dressed for a snowball fight than for archival research. And what they're doing, they're preserving those books.
Well, Bacon was onto something.
Bacon was onto something, but they had no idea that this we would use fossil fuels to, refrigerate their books and keep them from dying. So this is where what we've done is we've no pun undone here. This is hard to avoid, but we've actually preserved the book, the book itself, the one from 1633, which I have to say, I don't think they truly thought that book, that 1633 book that we have next door would be around in it almost 400 years later. A copy of it, maybe, but that book itself, not when you die from refrigerating chickens.
Well, speaking of animals and the outdoors, you have a fascinating story from, we're going forward in time now, from the Lewis and Clark expedition. And
yeah.
An incident in which the print fails. Because it is dependent upon a certain environment for success.
That's right. Well, yeah, paper is hygroscopic. Paper, as you know, it just wants to absorb water. And one of the reasons that if you, thankfully, your jeans go through the wash and you left your $20 bill in there, and it's not ruined. You'll notice this. You think, your receipt is, and it's because the paper that's used, or the fibers that are used to make the paper, that's the money. That's a cloth. It's a recycled cloth, and so it lasts. But paper that's just it gets damaged enough that it'll start to break down. If you ran it through the wash, a few dozen times, you start to have some trouble with it. And so what we see with Lewis and Clark is, I think, a fascinating example where you've got a European communication technologies coming up against Native American communication technologies. And now it's been too long since I've looked at this, but my memory of it is that they come to a fork, and they're going to split, or they're going to split into two groups, and the group that's ahead comes to a fork, and they want to make sure that the group behind them knows which way they went. And so they take a small tree, a sapling, they cut it, and they they write, you know, a note to the team that's back there, and they stick, you know, kind of fork it through and stick it up, and they stick it in this, you know, on the bank, and they stick that pole down into the sand, and on they go. Of course, it, you know, if this were watching a play, we know exactly what's going to happen next, right? I mean, it rains. They never see the note. Meanwhile, you've got ways of communicating across distance through smoke signals. You've also got communication other means of communicating that's being used in Native American cultures, one of which is the use of birch bark. And what's interesting is we don't know that we don't have records that they actually did this, but they were asked by Jefferson to keep a second copy of their journals on birch bark because it's not hygroscopic in the way. It won't be ruined in the water. I don't think that they took that advice.
Now, how do we translate all this into contemporary terms and so far as comparing the effect of the book, the printed book, the early printed book of John Donne or Shakespeare or even the Bible with the electronic media now? I mean, is there any sense that we're missing something, or is it really just parallel to what was going on back then?
Well, we're always missing something. This is the problem with curious people, right? You're always had that sense, but absolutely, I think that because I teach literature, I'm interested in this stuff. I'm interested in the materials, but I'm interested in the possibilities that stuff allows. What does the, you know, how can we think about nature with nature? That's how we've always done it, how we've always preserved our ideas. I have a good enough idea. I want to save it. What can I use to save it? So, you know, yeah, we could think about the scarcity of certain materials. Now it's rare earth materials, minerals. We could think about corruptibility of these different objects, things that just, you know, are going to decay. But we also think about the possibility. I mean, one of the things about poetry is that it relies on the fear of loss.
Sure.
It relies on saying I have to write this down before it's gone so I can save you, but it won't last. But I have to do the best I can.
A damsel with a dulcimer in a vision once I saw.
Exactly. That fear that it's going to go away it permeates the way that we think about poetry, about love, about desire. If we had it at all times, it wouldn't have the same resonance for us. And so I think that the nature of the book is to decay and to go away. And then how can you revive it? And I brought one really good example, I think, of how you can take take another narrative and merge it into a new narrative. And so in Aldo Leopold's A Sand County Almanac, he writes that many historical events hitherto explained solely in terms of human enterprise were actually biotic interactions between people and the land. The characteristics of the land determine the facts quite as potently as the characteristics of those who lived on it. And the way that Leopold is thinking, even, you know, elsewhere, he finds a driftboard that he's examining. He's trying to say, I can learn about the farmer who had this before,
right,
by looking at it.
Into it.
And he says, you know, one can even, you know, each old board has its own individual history, always unknown, but always to some degree guessable. And I love that, to some degree guessable. I think we can look at our communication technologies, and we don't know what's in them, but you can start to guess them. So start to ask yourself questions about this. The cool object I have here is a book that it's a reprint of Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac, and it's made on the paper that this book was printed on was made from the pine trees that he and his family planted out in Baraboo. And there's just a beautiful little. I'll read one small thing from Nina. And Carl and Estella, his children, leave this note here. They say, there is a happy continuity between Otto Leopold's message being carried along over the generations and his precious pine trees becoming the medium, the paper on which we print his moving words. I think it's a way to take that story of a past and the story of the Sand County Almanac and then refresh it, and it will last as long as it lasts, and somebody else will refresh it again.
Well, it's full circle then.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fascinating the way these writings, the books, and the environment flow back and forth over the course of time. And, of course, some of the themes, the theme of preservation of the idea remains the same.
Yeah.
Well, Joshua Calhoun, a pleasure seeing you again and going through this world of printing and paper and its relationship to the environment.
Thank you so much.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.